All right, I think we'll get started. So my name is Jean-François Nadeau, or call me Jeff. I work for Ticketmaster as a system engineer.
My name is Syed. I am a cloud architect at CloudOps.
And Syed worked with us with our project. So let's get started. Ticketmaster introduction. So rapidly, most people think of Ticketmaster as maybe a single entity or, you know, a single product, something like that, or just a website, ticketmaster.com. Well, in fact, it's 24 different ticketing systems and companies that have been acquired through the years. Myself, I'm from a smaller ticketing system in Quebec City called Microflex. Now Microflex is just one of those 21 systems. Overall, it's like 250 different internal products. So internally, we develop, maintain, operate all of those ticketing systems for the various aspects of ticketing. Like, there's not one system to rule them all, unfortunately. So there are some systems that are good for subscriptions, more for sports, other for concerts. So that's why there is a diversity of systems and products. Overall, Ticketmaster US, we're talking about 1,400 people working in operations, product, technology. I'm on the infrastructure side of the house, so I manage the basically the on-prem cloud. Ticketmaster overall, that's 15,000-ish endpoints. So anything from kiosk venues, arenas, all those endpoints are capable to sell tickets, basically. And also Ticketmaster, I mean, that's basically what we say, is 40 years of tech debt. As it goes as far as the VAX, and yes, the VAX still works today. It's no longer a physical VAX. We emulate the VAX, but that's just one of those 21 ticketing systems. So we have really pretty much of everything on the hardware side of thing, on the platform side of thing. We have Windows, Linux, and VAX. So the vending machine, the ticket vending machine. So most of our product today runs in our data centers. We do have some cloud presence. Some products are best fit, are more cloud native for public cloud. But most of our products are still running either bare metal or virtual machines on our own premises. And you can guess with that many ticketing system and product teams, because it's not a single team that manages all of those products, we had to break down our internal cloud into something more manageable. So we came with this idea of tenants. So a tenants, you can see that maybe a bit like a product group or a business unit. For us, it's a way to break down the resources that are allocated to that tenant and also to secure it, because the boundaries around tenants, the logical breakdown around it, is enforced at the network level. So a really classical way to see security, I mean, years before software-defined networking was a thing, so we do enforce stuff through physical firewalls still today, VLANs, networks. So if we look at the infrastructure before we started the actual migration from where we were to CloudStack, so the on-prem cloud is roughly 18,000 VMs, mostly Linux base, running on roughly 1,000 hypervisors. And that's on Xen server. So we've been on Xen server for like a good 10 years-ish on the free version of Xen server. And to manage all those hypervisors, we came with our own self-service portal. So we wrote our own code, I mean, years before, you know, OpenStack or CloudStack was a thing. So we wrote something that would abstract all that complexity. So how an end user consumes our cloud through that portal is really all they have to know is what's the class of system and what's the application cluster. They never think of infrastructure at any level. They really just type in the host name, and as part of that host name, there's pretty much everything embedded into it. What's the class of system and where it's going to run. So end user really doesn't know what a tenant is, what's a network, what's an IP address. They don't know that. So that's how our cloud grew. That's pretty much how things are. Luckily, our VMs are also pretty stateless. We don't have runtime code directly on them. It's traditionally what we've done to simplify management of that platform is most of the code runs from a shared file system. So that gives us the ability to re-spin our virtual machines pretty easily. But with time, I mean, Xen Server worked just fine for years, and we really liked it. The thing is, you know, when Xen Server changed their licensing term at the end of last year, well, we were at some crossroads. Like, what do we do? Do we invest massively in Xen Server for several years? Do we commit again for Xen Server for a long time? Or is it time just to revisit our options and switch to something else? I mean, maybe KVM, it could have been VMware. So we're just at crossroads. Also, the homegrown portal, I mean, that was great before the star stack systems. But really, it's just a UI. And there wasn't any investment in building an API on top of it. And that was the number one complaint about from our end users, that we don't have a programmatic way to interact with the on-prem cloud. So what alternative did we have from that starting point? So we could have paid for Xen Server, you know, and commit for several years. But if we were just moving our current cloud, pay for Xen Server, the end result doesn't change anything for the user. We would still manage, you know, the cloud with that portal with no APIs. So that's not an actual improvement. The alternatives would be to revisit OpenStack again. So we went through this once. It was, actually, it's the next slide. So it goes back to Havana. So it's a while back still. But it was a very difficult journey. The main problems were, well, the control plane complexity was one thing. So how many months we spent, you know, using our own config management system to deploy OpenStack. And we still had to integrate the existing environment. We don't really have the opportunity to do a greenfield and, okay, we start from scratch and we're going to ask 200 product teams to move their virtual machine, recreate their virtual machine into a completely different network environment. That's not an option for us, unfortunately. The only option that's given to us is if it's okay to reprovision a virtual machine, because since they are mostly stateless, that's fine, but the network identity has to remain, because we still have physical load balancers around in virtual machines, you know, as members of those application pools. So we needed a way, you know, destroy the VM, create the VM, but it needs to be on the same IP and on the same host name. That was the single biggest constraint of our journey. So why we choose CloudStack? So obviously installing CloudStack is way easier than OpenStack. You don't have 12 moving parts and 12 databases, and each have its own HA way of being HA. So yeah, I mean, just simply having an RPM to install, a few RPMs to install, and you can be running in no time. The HA model is super simple. We tested that pretty extensively. And the single biggest aspect is how can we integrate CloudStack next to Xen Server and Portal without having everybody to, you know, change everything. So that was our mission. We're going to destroy VMs, recreate them, same network identity, and that's where Side help a lot. Side work on the API extension. So we needed to mimic a bit of what the portal was doing in CloudStack. We couldn't just do greenfield CloudStack, and that's where Side helped us basically implement the same business logic and the same constraint, like, our current networking, we use an IPAM device. If you guys are familiar with either BlueCat or Infoblox, well, we use those kind of things. And we can't just create an island for CloudStack. CloudStack has to live with the existing IPAM solution, something that does not exist out of the box. So we had to basically write it. And also, by moving to CloudStack, it was an opportunity to adopt KVM. So KVM have been out there for long enough. We deem it's mature enough to take the load of our production systems. So that was the time to set up a different hypervisor. And then I'll...
All right, I'll take it from here. All right, so as you already know, the history of how Ticketmaster was dealing with their infrastructure and the sort of specific needs they have, they couldn't just go with bare-bones cloud stack installation just because they have such a strong networking requirement, which is completely different from any of the cloud, any of the private cloud services that offer. None of them sort of meet those needs, but CloudStack is malleable enough that you can change a lot of things in CloudStack without writing a lot of code. So that's what we ended up doing. So the primary need for Ticketmaster was that they maintain the same network identity as GF explained. So the idea was to, the idea was to delegate all the IP address management and all the DNS management to their existing IPAM solution. So that means when you spin up a VM in CloudStack, there is no network assignment by CloudStack. All the DHCP, DNS, and other services like metadata services are external to CloudStack. So luckily, if you create an isolated guest network in CloudStack, you have the ability to choose which services you want to have in that network. So if you uncheck all the services, that means CloudStack will just create a bare-bones network with a particular VLAN. That's all it does. So it's a very good fit for Ticketmaster. Now, there are some extra things that we had to do, as I will explain. In Ticketmaster, they have five availability zones spread across three regions. What we have done is each zone, we have done a CloudStack installation. So the idea is all the availability zones become CloudStack zones. And each zone has an HA master. So here's an interesting sort of a twist, which we have done. Tenants become projects. So in Ticketmaster, tenants are basically project groups. And the way they have done isolation is they've assigned networks to each product group. So if I'm a user and I belong to certain project groups, my access control is defined by which networks I have access to. So what we have done is we've mapped tenants to projects. Now, the reason why we have done this sort of thing is also coming back to some of the drawbacks in CloudStack, that we could not go for tenants mapping to, let's say, domains. We could not use the domain hierarchy, and JF will explain that in his last slide. But regardless, what we have done is you will have a single domain, like a root domain, and there are multiple projects in that root domain. Now, each project, as I said, is a tenant group, and each project will have multiple networks assigned to it. Now, the whole isolation being served from networks is a key, because what projects allow you to do is add a single user to multiple projects. You cannot do this with domains. So that is why we chose projects. Now, all of this information about which user has access to what comes from the Active Directory. So Active Directory is basically being the source of truth. And from there, we get all the information about the access control. Luckily, CloudStack also has a very good Active Directory integration. So adding users and managing them is not a problem. All right, so the way we have approached Ticketmaster's use case is the first thing we've done is we have created APIs for interacting with all the services that are there in Ticketmaster. And there's another colleague of ours, his name is Craig. He could not be here, unfortunately, but he played a major role in writing those APIs. So once that API layer is done, what we could do is we could sort of use that API and then create VMs in a way that is updating the external systems to CloudStack. So in CloudStack, when you deploy a virtual machine, there is an API call called deploy virtual machine. So that is the API call you use to create a new virtual machine. What we have done in the case of Ticketmaster is we've created a new API called TM deploy virtual machine. So what this does is when you create a VM using this Ticketmaster specific API, it goes and updates external services. It figures out which network that VM needs to be a part of, and then it calls back the traditional CloudStack specific API call, which then interacts with the hypervisor. So by adding this API, what we've done is we've added a layer on top of the standard deploy virtual machine, and that layer is specific to Ticketmaster's infrastructure. So one other, like, a good point about CloudStack, as Jeff had mentioned, is this process were pretty much seamless. The extension of API in CloudStack is because CloudStack is so pluggable, it's just like you have a jar and you place the jar in the right folder and restart CloudStack, and that takes care of everything. So there is no complex installation, there is no dependency management. Just drop the jar and then restart, and you're good to go. Now, once we have had that service layer and we have a way to deploy virtual machines, what we had written is an API layer for which allows us to migrate VMs from older infrastructure to the newer infrastructure, which is the newer infrastructure is running KVM under CloudStack. The older infrastructure was running Zen Server. So what we wrote is a migration API, which goes to Zen Server, picks out a VM, and then migrates it to the CloudStack KVM setup. Now, we wanted this to be as off-hand as possible, so we don't want an ops person or an ops team to do the migration, because if you've seen the previous slides, there are 16,000 VMs. So it's not just a single team can migrate all of them without any problems. So the idea was to make it self-served. So on that note, we also created some CLI tools which will allow end users to just run migration on their own VMs. So when I say end users, it's basically the owners of those product groups or the teams who work for the specific products group. They can, based on their availability and based on their maintenance schedule, can migrate their own workload. So the less coordination they have, the more flexibility they have in terms of when and what they want to migrate. And then we did a setup of the LDAP. As I mentioned, CloudStack already has an integration with LDAP, so that was pretty seamless. Although, like, there was some additional script that JF had to write to, because each user needs to be a part of specific projects. So that kind of mapping was done by writing a script which runs periodically, and that was written by JF. And then finally, the project domain setup. So what this is, it's sort of a one-time thing where you take existing projects from an older system, which they have the IPAM system or their inventory system. So taking an older system and then creating specific domains and specific projects in CloudStack. So that's just a one-time thing which you have to do. And after that, everything should work. Now, the migration steps into CloudStack. So the way the migration works is the first two steps we've already done, which is basically adding new services to CloudStack which interact with Ticketmaster specific infrastructure, and the other thing is the APIs which can be called on to run the migration. So those were the first two sort of the development phases, and then the operation phases start. So the way the migration works is, let's say a VM is running in Xen. So what we do is we shut down the VM and we create a new VM in CloudStack. And after the VM creation is successful, we just update the IPAM services and the inventories, and everything starts pointing to the newer VM. And once we boot the new VM, Ticketmaster has an internal configuration management system called Rabbix. So Rabbix will just boot the VM and then configure it, install all the software, security updates, et cetera, et cetera. And once that is done, we do sort of a verification phase to make sure that the VM is conformant. There are some cases where the VM might not boot, or let's say the configuration management was not able to assign or install specific software, or the IPAM system didn't get update on the MAC address. So there's a lot of edge cases where things can go wrong. So we have to be resilient enough that if things do go wrong, we don't end up in a state where we've lost the old VM and we cannot create the new VM. So that would be very bad. So that is the reason why we don't destroy the old VM right away. So we do a verification that everything is running smoothly on the newer in CloudStack, like it got the IP address, it's pingable, has the installed software, et cetera, et cetera. So once all the verification is done, then we go ahead and then we destroy the old VM. Now, we have also written a revert, or all of these steps that we're doing, we're making sure that they're idempotent. So at any point, if there is any failure, things are going to revert back to a normal case, which was like the old state. So we also save the old state and the progress. So it's a pretty idempotent operation. So and we've tested it a lot, and there are some edge cases, but for the most part, it works. Now, after all that said and done, the project was in April of this year, and by now, all the non-prod VMs in Ticketmaster have been migrated to the CloudStack plus KVM setup. So if you count all in all, there are about 6,000 VMs currently running in CloudStack, which is spread across 5 zones in 2 regions. Now, it's not just non-prod VMs, but CloudStack plus the CloudStack and KVM setup is being used for VMs which are in production and actively serving traffic. And the complete migration of all the 16,000 or so VMs is a couple of months away. So that are basically the key wins so far. And I'll hand it over to Jeff.
Thank you. So we learned a few things by migrating. Well, it's not just to CloudStack, but also from Xen server to different hypervisors. Those are a bit unorganized thoughts that, you know, what we learn in our journey. Like KVM live migrations are different Xen server live migration in respect to when you migrate a virtual machine with Xen server, you don't really have to monitor it or think about it much. It's just completes. It is generally slow, but it completes. When we migrated to KVM, we realized that when you put a host in maintenance, well, first live migration is extremely fast, but it is faster than you want it to be, in the sense that it's going to fill all the bandwidth you have if you haven't carefully provisioned enough bandwidth for live migration to happen. It's just going to eat all bandwidth that you have. So that's a good thing. It's a good problem, but we were just not ready for it. And the way it works with the agent is that the CloudStack agent has by default 5 workers. And even though you can throttle the bandwidth live migration takes, it's the throttle for each migration. So by default, 5 workers. So if you don't set any limit, well, technically it's capable of filling 50 gig worth of bandwidth. So we had to kind of, you know, slow it down a bit. So we still want migration to happen fast, but not necessarily at the expense of all the bandwidth that is available. And it's a bit particular because we have some of our hypervisor fleet by the in the old Xen server design, we didn't add a network specifically for live migration. So we have shared system networks. So that's why it became a problem. But knowing that, I mean, there are some tunables in the CloudStack agent. So you just need to keep in mind that when you throttle live migration, it's on a per migration basis. So depending on how many threads are actually driving the migrations, then it's your bandwidth goes up till you don't have any. In our design, we took for the HA. So the second point is about how we did the HA. We took pretty much the recipe out of the box with 2 controllers, and we also co-hosted the database on those controllers. So even though we would use shared storage, we would diversify storage in a way that there's not a single point of failure. Like, we don't use NFS for the 2 databases because the NFS would become, you know, maybe a point of failure. But what we do realize is in that default setup, if you co-host controllers and 2 databases, you can create a split brain situation if you have some sort of network partition. Well, you got the secondary controller, per se, that's going to start writing locally. So normally, in a standard failure mode where you either lose the controller entirely or the storage of the first controller, the failover works just fine. In this case, what happens is that the secondary controller believes it's isolated from the first one, starts writing to the database locally, and then you have a problem when the other guy comes back because you've written on both databases and the multi-master setup doesn't catch up. Well, it's going to break. So it's up to you to fix it at that point. There are other approaches than that one. That's just the simplest model. I know many people use Perkonov or I always forget the name. Not Perkonov. Galera. Yeah. So Galera to avoid a problem. But since we don't ever, internally, we were more at ease with MySQL in general. We don't have a MySQL clustering or MariaDB clustering in-house. So we just went with the standard HA model. So it's just one thing to remember that when you use the standard HA model, think about split brains, can happen. One thing we learned is that with all the tenants, project, networks, just creating the hosts, I mean, we have more than 1,000 hypervisors, we can't possibly manually create that infrastructure. So we've used the built-in Ansible modules for that. So they were very, very handy. I would say that they're not 100% functionally complete because there's some things you can do straight through the API that you can't do through the Ansible module, unfortunately. But the Ansible modules are getting great.
One thing I would like to add on the Ansible modules is that most Ansible modules work as long as you don't have a project. So as soon as you have this project, most Ansible modules were not written to handle projects. So when you pass in a project ID, they just ignore it. So I think we've seen that.
Yep. So what happened is that for the areas where Ansible was not functionally complete, I had to, do a shell and called CloudMonkey or CS directly just for that single task that couldn't be handled statefully into Ansible. The other point about RBAC. So I would say, I mean, Ticketmaster does not necessarily represent, the most typical use case because we have people that move from a product team to another. So for a period of time, they can work on something and then, okay, they work to something else. The problem we had is at first we thought of a simpler model where we would use only AD groups, all right, and logically a user can be member of multiple groups, right, in Active Directory. What you can't do in Cloud Stack is import the same user multiple times. You import the LDAP user once. So that became kind of a problem for us. So what we ended up doing in scripting is I'm using just a field about the group membership of a user as encoded the name of the projects. So we import the users into project based on that specific field. It's just because RBAC is not yet where I think it should be. Another thing, I don't know if anyone here still uses ext3 on any VM. Probably not. I've put that there because that's our case. We have some legacy system that still use ext3. Just be aware that ext3 out of the box on KVM is not safe. So there's something called write barriers on file systems. That's on an old modern file system. It's not on ext3 by default. So we learn, that's a hard lesson learned, that when there's an hypervisor crash, we notice that some VM would recover by themselves, some would not. And ext3 is the culprit. So if you do run ext3, do have write barriers on. XAPI, yes, so the reliability of XAPI when we interact with it, mostly we're talking about the migration code here. So XAPI generally works well, but the bigger the Xen pool or the number of VMs into a Xen server pool, we've seen XAPI be pretty slow or even timeout on tasks. So it's just, that's not even KVM or Cloud Stack directly related. It's more a lesson learned from our migration that sometime a migration would fail, and what is it? Yeah, XAPI timeout. I think that's about all we had. Anything to add? No. So I think we're Q&A. Yes. Okay, so the ext3 problem relates to ext3 in the virtual machine. Like if you run an Oracle Linux 5, for instance, and by default ext3, well, Red Hat did not add write barriers enabled. Not only that, but as of OL5 or Red Hat 5, you couldn't even do write barriers on LVM. So that came later, I think, to 6.32, something like that. So it's really just about when there's a crash, regardless of the mode you're running your libvirt root disk. In our case, they were on NFS, but I think that would apply to anything, is that at first I thought like the caching mode none to be safe. I mean, it's safe in the sense that if there's something that goes down the I/O path, I mean, the virtual disk is open with ODirect. So there's no buffering in the chain. The problem is the ext3 itself that did some metadata updates and didn't do fsyncs. So the hard lesson learned is we had an hypervisor crash and we look like it could be, we have like 30 to 50 VMs per hypervisor now, pretty high density. And all the ext3 based VM would be in recovery mode. Well, everything that runs ext4 or EXFS just, hey, we have HA and we recover. That's nice. So we had to and fix those. That was the problem. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was just wondering if any of the migration tools that you developed or a portion of those tools would be generic enough that it would make sense to maybe open source of those to help some other people who are doing the same things you're doing, help them along?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that we should visit. The XAPI part is probably generic enough. There are many strings in our infrastructure that goes with our source of truth. The asset database is RTAT, request tracker, asset tracker. So the thing is, for us to find a source of truth, we were collecting data from that, and then we do like the XAPI part, like find the pool where the VM is. That's an RTAT call. Okay, that's that pool. and by our naming convention, oh, well, you know how to craft the host name of the Xen server master. So I would definitely look what we can open source. I don't think there isn't any secret in that code. It's just very tied to RT as a source of truth. But I point noted,
it needs to be made more pluggable. So plug in additional weight of sources of truth. Just not RT.
Yep. Yes, sir. Yes, well, actually what happened, the limitation that we had, the biggest limitation were as of Ansible 2.4, and most of them went away with 2.5. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. I remember we did send an update for him because it was based on API. I think it was 4.8. There was some missing. Well, anyway, it responded very fast, and you got the code regenerated for 4.11. Correct. There is no persistent data on a root disk. That's been like a rule for application group that when you build on our on-prem cloud, I mean, if you want to lose something, do put something on the local file system, and you're going to lose it at some point. Yep. Yes, totally. I mean, what really helped is we have a very archaic config management system. It was homebrewed, but still, that's what allowed us to destroy a VM and just recreate it. And the config management just put it back where it is. So that's why most of the self-migration, we actually engage EPAM to do some of them. Just do 300-400 VMs a morning, and we'll just see what didn't go just as expected. I mean, 99% of the migration went just well. When we had problems, it was our IPAM was timing out, no DHCP leads, something like that. There's one thing we had to do that is a bit special, is that back in the days of Xen server, when a virtual machine boots, like the template, we instantiate a template, I mean, you can call the Xen store to know which host name you are, right? On KVM, there's a little challenge there because there's no such thing. So how a VM, I mean, on first boot and without user data, how do you get your own identity? Well, we just had to insert our own hooks to call like our IPAM device. So we're calling our IPAM API. So the VM, like, who am I? And then the configuration starts. And still have a few minutes. All right. Well, thank you. Okay.